Leviathan, Part 1, Man, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 4 and 5. Chapter 4, Speech. The invention of printing, though ingenious, is a minor affair compared with the invention of writing. This was a profitable invention, good for continuing the memory of the past, and also for interconnecting people dispersed far and wide across the earth. But it was also an invention that was difficult to make. It required careful observation of the different movements of the tongue, palate, lips, and other organs of speech, so as to make correspondingly different letters to remember them by. But the most noble and profitable invention of all was that of speech, consisting of names or appellations, and ways of connecting them. Men use speech to register their present thoughts, to recall their past thoughts, and to declare their thoughts to one another for mutual utility in conversation. Without speech, men would not have had commonwealth, or society, or contract, or peace, any more than lions, bears, and wolves do. The first author of speech was Adam, who named the created things that God presented to his sight. We don't know how he went about doing this, for the Scripture says no more about it. But this was sufficient to lead him to add more names, as his experience and use of created things gave him a need for them, and gradually to come to join them together in ways that would let him make himself understood. And so in the course of time he could achieve as much language as he found a use for, though not as rich a language as an orator or philosopher needs. For I don't find anything in the Scripture which explicitly says, or which implies, that Adam gave names to every variety of figures, numbers, measures, colours, sounds, fancies, relations, much less that he imposed the names of words and parts or kinds of speech, such as general, special, affirmative, negative, interrogative, optative, infinitive, all which are useful, and least of all the meaningless words of the schools. But all this language that was achieved and enlarged by Adam and his descendants was lost again at the Tower of Babel, when every man was punished by God for his rebellion, by being made to forget his former language. And as these men were forced by this to disperse into different parts of the world, it must be that the variety of tongues that we now have was gradually brought about by them, that is, by men scattered throughout the world, in such ways as met their needs, need being the mother of all inventions, and eventually language everywhere became more copious. What speech is for, to put it in the most general terms, is to carry our mental discourse over into verbal discourse, or the train of our thoughts into a train of words. This is useful to us in two ways, one private, the other public. One is the registering of our thought sequences. These are apt to slip out of our memory, putting us to the trouble of recovering them, and we can be helped in that by recalling the words they were marked by. So that the first use of names is to serve for marks or notes of remembrance. The other occurs when many people use the same words to signify to one another, by the connection and order of the words, what they conceive or think about each matter, and also what they desire, fear, or have any other passion for. Words used in this way are called signs. There are four special uses of speech. First, to register what we have found through our thoughts to be the cause of anything, present or past, and what we think the effects will be of things present or past. All this amounts to the acquiring of arts, that is, of knowledge relating to practical skills. Second, to show to others the knowledge we have attained, which is to advise and teach one another. Third, to make known to others our wants and purposes, so that we can help one another. Fourth, to please and delight ourselves and others by innocently playing with our words for pleasure or ornament. Corresponding to these uses, there are four misuses of speech. First, when men register their thoughts wrongly through inconstancy in the meanings of their words, leading them to register for their conceptions something that they never conceived, thus deceiving themselves. Second, when they use words metaphorically, that is, in senses other than the ones they are ordained to have, thereby deceiving others. Third, when by words they declare something to be what they want, which is not what they want. Fourth, when they use words to injure one another. For seeing that nature has enabled living creatures to injure their enemies, some with teeth, some with horns, and some with hands, it is just a misuse of speech to injure someone with the tongue, unless it is someone whom we are obliged to govern. And even then our role is not to injure or insult, but to correct and improve. How does speech help us to remember sequences of causes and effects? By imposing names on things and making connections among the names. Some names are proper and apply to only one thing. For example, Peter, John, this man, this tree. Others are common to many things, for example, man, horse, tree. Each of these is just a single name, but it is the name of many particular things, and considered as a blanket name for all of them, it is called a universal. For the only universal things in the world are merely names. The things named are every one of them individual and singular. One universal name is imposed on many things, on the basis of their likeness in some quality or feature. And whereas a proper name brings to mind only one thing, universals recall any one of those many. Among universal names, some are of greater extent and some of lesser, with the former including the latter in their extent. And some pairs of universal names are of equal extent, each including the other. For example, the name body has a larger range of application than the word man, and includes it. And the names man and rational are of equal extent, each including the other. I should point out that a name is not necessarily a single word, as it is in grammar. Sometimes it consists of many words together. For the words, "he who in his actions observes the laws of his country," constitutes a single name, equivalent to the one word name, just. By this imposition of names, some with wider scope and some with narrower, we turn calculations concerning sequences of things imagined in the mind into calculations concerning sequences of names. Here is an example. Suppose that a man with no use of speech at all, like someone born totally deaf and dumb, who remains so, looks at a triangle, and, beside it, two right angles, such as the corners of a square. He may thoughtfully compare them, and find that the three angles of that triangle are equal to the two right angles at its side. But if another triangle is shown to him, different in shape from the former one, he can't know without working it out all over again, whether the three angles of this second triangle are also equal to the two right angles. Compare that with someone who has the use of words. When he observes that the equality depends not on the length of the triangle's sides, or on any other details about it, but only on the fact that its sides are straight and its angles three, and that this was the basis for his naming it a triangle, he will boldly draw the universal conclusion that such equality of angles occurs in all triangles whatsoever, and will register his discovery in these general terms. Every triangle has its three angles equal to two right angles. And thus the thought sequence, found in one particular case, comes to be registered and remembered as a universal rule. That removes time and place from our mental calculation, lets us off from all labour of the mind, except the first labour of proving the universal rule, and makes what we find to be true here and now to be true at all times and places. But the use of words in registering our thoughts is nowhere else as evident as it is in numbering. A natural fool, that is a congenitally intellectually deprived person, who could never learn by heart the order of the numerals, 1, 2, and 3, may hear every stroke of the clock and nod to it, or say, 1, 1, 1. But he can never know what hour it strikes. And it seems that there was a time when those names of numbers were not in use, and men had to use the fingers of one or both their hands to keep tallies of things. And that's why numeral words today go no higher than 10 in any nation, and in some only up to 5, and then they begin again. And someone who can count to 10 will, if he recites the numerals out of order, lose himself, and not know when he has recited them all. Much less will he be able to add and subtract and perform all the other operations of arithmetic. So that without words, it is impossible to calculate with numbers, still less with sizes, speeds, degrees of force, and other things that have to be calculated if mankind is to survive and flourish. When two names are joined together into a sequence or affirmation, such as, "A man is a living creature," or, "If he is a man, he is a living creature." If the second name, "living creature," applies to everything that the first name, "man," applies to, then the affirmation or name sequence is true. Otherwise, it is false. For true and false are attributes of speech, not of things. Where there is no speech, there is neither truth nor falsehood. There may be error, as when we expect something that doesn't happen, or suspect something that has not happened. But in neither case can a man be accused of untruth. Seeing, then, that truth consists in the right ordering of names in our affirmations, a man who seeks precise truth needs to remember what every name he uses stands for, and to place it accordingly. Otherwise, he will find himself entangled in words, like a bird in lime twigs. The more he struggles, the more thoroughly he is caught in the sticky stuff. And therefore, in geometry, which is virtually the only precise science, men begin by settling the meanings of their words in what they call definitions, which they place at the start of their calculations. This brings out how necessary it is for anyone who aspires to true knowledge to examine the definitions of previous authors, and either to make them his own, or, when they are negligently set down, to correct them. For errors in definitions multiply themselves as the calculation proceeds, leading men into absurdities which eventually they see, but can't avoid without starting again from the beginning, which contains the source of their errors. That is how it happens that those who trust books behave like those who add up many little sums into a bigger one, without checking the correctness of the ones they started with. And when at last they see that something has gone wrong, they don't know how to clear themselves of error. Instead of mistrusting the principles of their masters, as laid down in the books from which they started, they spend time fluttering over their books like birds trapped in a room, who flutter at the false light of a glass window because they haven't the intelligence to consider that they came in through the chimney. So the first use of speech is in the right definition of names, which is the acquisition of science, and the first misuse is in wrong definitions or the lack of definitions. The latter is the source of all false and senseless tenets, which make men who try to learn from books, rather than from their own meditation, to be as much below the condition of merely ignorant men, as men endued with true science are above it. For between true science and erroneous doctrines, mere ignorance is in the middle. Worse than true science, but better than false doctrines. Natural sense and imagination are not subject to absurdity. Nature itself can't err. Error is possible only where there is language. When someone comes to have a richly expressive language, he becomes wiser than average, or crazier. A man needs the use of writing if he is to become excellently wise, or excellently foolish. For words are wise men's counters, used merely in calculations, but they are the money of fools, who value them on the authority of an Aristotle, a Cicero, a Thomas Aquinas, or any other teacher. Names can be used for anything that can enter into an account, any things that can be added one to another to make a sum, or subtracted one from another to leave a remainder. The Latins called accounts of money rationes, and they called accounting ratio senatio. And from that usage, they seem to have gone on to extend the word ratio, meaning reason, to the ability to calculate generally in all other things as well as with numbers. The Greeks have only one word, logos, for both speech and reason, not because they thought there is no speech without reason, but because they thought there is no reasoning without speech, and they called the act of reasoning syllogism, which means adding the consequences of one statement to those of another. Now, a single thing can enter into an account on the basis of different features of it. So the names of things come to be diverted from their original meanings and diversified so as to stand for different features. This variety among names can be brought under four general headings. First, a thing may enter into account as matter or body under such labels as living, sensible, rational, hot, cold, moved, quiet. With all these names, the word matter or body is understood, because they are all names of matter, that is, stand for properties that only matter can have. Second, a thing can enter into account or be considered for some feature or quality that we conceive to be in it. For example, being moved, being a foot long, being hot, etc. And then we divert the name of the thing into being a name for the feature or quality that we are considering. For living, we put into the account life. For moved, we put motion. For hot, we put heat. For long, we put length, and the like. And these and their like are the names of the features and properties by which one matter, body, is distinguished from another. These are called abstract names, not because the features or properties are separated from matter, but because their names are separated from the account of matter. Third, we bring into account the properties of our own bodies through which we distinguish things. For example, when we see something, we don't talk about the thing itself, but rather the sight, the colour, the idea of it in the fancy. And when we hear something, we talk not about it, but about the hearing or sound only, which is our fancy or conception of it through the ear. Such words as green and loud are names of fancies. Fourth, we bring into account and consider and give names to names themselves, and to speeches. For general, universal, special, and equivocal, are names of names. An affirmation, interrogation, commandment, narration, syllogism, sermon, oration, and many other such are names of speeches. There are also other names called negative, whose role is to signify that a word is not the name of the thing in question. For example, nothing, no man, infinite, unteachable, and the like. They are of use in calculating and correcting calculations. They call to mind our past thoughts, but they are not names of anything, because all they do is to signify that some name, properly used, is not applicable to the item in question. All other names are merely insignificant sounds. There are two kinds of them. One occurs when a word is new, and its meaning not explained by definition. The schoolmen have coined new terms in abundance, thereby puzzling philosophers. The other occurs when men put together into a single name two names whose meanings are contradictory and inconsistent. For example, an incorporeal body, or, same thing, an incorporeal substance, and a great many more. For whenever an affirmation is false, the two names of which it is composed when put together and made into a single name signify nothing at all. For example, if it is false to say that a quadrangle is round, the word round quadrangle signifies nothing, and is a mere sound. Similarly, if it is false to say that virtue can be poured, or blown up and down, the words in-poured virtue and in-blown virtue are as absurd and insignificant as round quadrangle, although people have, absurdly, written of virtue as being infused and inspired. When you encounter a senseless and insignificant word, it is nearly always composed of Latin or Greek names. When a man hears some speech, and has the thoughts that those words in that order were ordained to signify, then he is said to understand it, understanding being nothing but conception caused by speech. So, if speech is confined to man, as it is for all I know, then understanding is also confined to him. It also follows that there can be no question of understanding an affirmation, if it is universally absurd and false, though many think they are understanding something when they really are merely repeating the words in a murmur, or running over them in their mind. The names of things that please or displease us have inconstant meanings in common discourse, because likes and dislikes vary from person to person, and even for one person at different times. All names are designed to signify our conceptions, and all our states are merely conceptions. So when you and I conceive one thing differently, we can hardly avoid naming it differently. Although the nature of the thing we conceive is the same, our different receptions of it, because of how we differ in the constitutions of our bodies and the prejudices of our opinions, give everything we say some flavour of our different passions. In reasonings, therefore, we must watch the words, for a word, besides signifying what we imagine to be the nature of the thing to which the word applies, also signifies the nature, disposition, and interests of the speaker. The names of virtues and vices are examples of this. One man calls wisdom what another calls fear. One calls cruelty what another calls justice. One calls wastefulness what another calls generosity, and so on. And therefore such names can never be secure bases for reasoning, nor can metaphors and figures of speech, but these are less dangerous, because they announce their inconstancy, which the others do not. Chapter 5. Reason and Science. When a man reasons, all he does is to conceive a sum total from the addition of portions, or conceive a remainder from the subtraction of one sum from another. If this is done in words, it is conceiving the name of the whole as coming from the names of all the parts, or conceiving the name of one part as coming from the names of the whole and of the other part. For some things, such as numbers, we have not only adding and subtracting, but also names for other operations, such as multiplying and dividing. Yet these are not wholly new operations, for multiplication is merely adding equal things together, and division is nothing but subtracting one thing as often as we can. These operations are performed not only with numbers, but with all sorts of things that can be added together and subtracted one from another. Just as arithmeticians teach how to add and subtract in numbers, so the geometricians teach how to do the same with lines, figures, two- and three-dimensional, angles, proportions, times, degrees of speed, force, power, and the like. The logicians teach the same with respect to sequences of words, adding together two names to make an affirmation, two affirmations to make a syllogism, and many syllogisms to make a proof, and from the sum or conclusion of a syllogism, they subtract one proposition to find the other. Writers on politics add together treaties and agreements to find men's duties, and lawyers add together laws and facts to find what is right and wrong in the actions of private men. In brief, wherever there is a place for addition and subtraction, there also is a place for reasoning, and where these have no place, reason has nothing to do. Out of all this, we can define, that is to say, fix, what is meant by the word reason, taken as naming one of the faculties of the mind. For reason, in this sense, is nothing but calculating, that is, adding and subtracting. Sequences of general names agreed on to mark and signify our thoughts. Mark them when we calculate by ourselves, and signify them when we are demonstrating or recommending our calculations to other men. People not practiced in arithmetic are bound to make mistakes and get wrong answers, and even expert arithmeticians can do so. And in any other subject of reasoning also, the ablest, most careful, and most practiced men can deceive themselves and infer false conclusions. This is not to deny that reason itself is always right reason, but no one man's reason, nor even the reason of any group of men, however large, makes the conclusion certain. Similarly, arithmetic itself is a certain and infallible art, but no calculation is guaranteed to be right, just because a great many men have unanimously approved it. So when there is a controversy about some calculation, the disputants must on their own initiative agree on some arbitrator or judge whose reason they will accept as right reason, since no standard for right reason has been set up by nature, and the same thing holds in all debates of every kind. And when men who think themselves wiser than everyone else clamour and demand that right reason be the judge, yet actually seek that things should be settled by their reason and no one else's, it is as intolerable in the society of men as it would be in a card game if, after trumps had been settled, someone always played as trumps whatever suit he had most of in his hand at that moment. For that's what people are doing when they insist in any controversies they are involved in, that their strongest passion at a given moment shall count just then as right reason, revealing their lack of right reason by the claim they lay to it. What reason is for, and the right way to use it, is not to find the added-up truth of one or just a few word sequences that are remote from the first definitions and settled meanings of names, but to begin with the latter and proceed from one sequence to another. For one can't be certain of the final conclusion without being certain of all the affirmations and negations from which it was inferred. Suppose that the master of a household, when making up his accounts, adds up the sums of all the bills of expense into one large sum, without checking how each bill has been added up by the person who presented it to him, or looking into what he is paying for in each. He does himself no more good than if he just accepted the bottom line sum as calculated for him by an accountant, trusting the skill and honesty of all the accountants. There is no point in checking some parts of the calculation if one doesn't check them all. In the same way, someone who in reasoning about something, anything, starts by taking on trust the conclusions of authors, and doesn't derive them for himself from the proper starting points, he wastes his labour. And at the end of it all, he doesn't know anything, but merely believes. The proper starting points in every calculation are the meanings of names as settled by definitions. Suppose a man is calculating without the use of words. This is possible in relation to particular things, as when on seeing one thing we conjecture what was likely to have preceded it or is likely to follow it. If what he thought likely to follow doesn't follow, and what he thought likely to have preceded didn't proceed, this is called error, and even the most prudent men are subject to it. But when we are reasoning in words with general meanings, if we employ a general inference that is false, though this will commonly be called error, it is really an absurdity or senseless speech. For error is merely going wrong in presuming that something is past or to come, something which, even if in fact it is neither past nor to come, is not impossible so far as we can discover. But when we make a general assertion, unless it is a true one, the possibility of it is inconceivable. And words by which we conceive nothing but the sound are what we call absurd, insignificant, and nonsense. Thus, if a man were to talk to me of a round quadrangle, qualities of bread in cheese, immaterial substances, a free subject, a free will, or any sort of free other than freedom from being hindered by opposition, I would say not that he was in error, but rather that his words were absurd, having no meaning. As I said before, man surpasses all other animals, in that when he thinks about anything whatever, he is apt to inquire into its consequences, and what he can do with it. I now add something else, in which man surpasses the other animals. Though really it is a development of the excellence just discussed. It is that man can, by the use of words, get the conclusions he arrives at into general rules, called theorems. That is, he can reason or calculate, not only with numbers, but with things of any sort in which one can be added to or subtracted from another. But this privilege is lessened through being accompanied by another, namely, the privilege of absurdity. Absurdity besets no living creature except man, and among men, the ones most subject to it are the philosophers. For what Cicero says of them somewhere is most true, that there can be nothing too absurd to be found in books by philosophers. The reason for this is obvious. It is that they never begin their thinking from the starting point of definitions or explanations of the names they plan to use, which is a method that has been used in geometry, making its conclusions indisputable, and hasn't been used anywhere else. I shall now list 7 causes of absurdity. The first cause of absurd conclusions is the lack of method, or anyway of the right method, in that they don't start from definitions, that is, from settled meanings for their words, as if they could make up accounts without knowing the value of the words 1, 2, and 3. Bodies come to be talked about on the basis of different features of them, and ways of looking at them, and those bring with them differences in names. This allows various absurdities to come from confusing these different names, and connecting them improperly into assertions. And therefore, the second cause of absurd assertions is the giving of names of bodies to qualities, or of qualities to bodies. That's what people do when they say that faith is infused or inspired into someone, when really only body can be poured or breathed into anything, or that extension is body, when really it is a quality of body, that phantasms are spirits, when they really are states of animals, and so on. The third cause of absurdity is giving to qualities of our own bodies the names of qualities of bodies external to us, which is what people do when they say that the colour is in the body, the sound is in the air, and so on. The fourth cause is the giving of names, or speeches to bodies, which is what people do when they say that there are universal things, that a living creature is a genus, or a general thing, and so on. The fifth cause is the giving to qualities names of names and speeches, which is what people do when they say that the nature of a thing is its definition, a man's command is his will, and the like. The sixth cause of absurdity is the use of metaphors, figures of speech and other rhetorical devices, instead of words used strictly in their proper senses. In common speech, it is all right to say, for example, "The path goes that way," or "leads that way," or to say, "The proverb says such and such." But really, paths cannot go, and proverbs cannot speak. So that in calculation and seeking the truth, such turns of phrase are not to be admitted. The seventh cause of absurdity is the use of names that don't mean anything, but are learned by rote from the schools. For example, hypostatic, transubstantiate, consubstantiate, eternal now, and similar cant from the schoolmen. Someone who can avoid all these things won't easily fall into any absurdity, unless what he is saying or writing is very long, and in the later parts he forgets what he said earlier. For all men naturally reason in the same way, and reason well when they have good principles. No one is so stupid as both to make a mistake in geometry, and also to persist in the mistake after it has been pointed out to him. From all this it appears that reason is not born with us, like sense and memory, or acquired through experience alone, as prudence is, but achieved through work. First there is the work of giving suitable names to things, then the work of developing a good and orderly method for proceeding from names to assertions, made by connecting names with one another, and thence to syllogisms, which are the connections of one assertion to another, till we come to the knowledge of all the consequences of names relating to the subject in hand, and that is what men call science. And whereas sense and memory are merely knowledge of fact, which is a past thing, and irrevocable, because it is past, science is the knowledge of consequences, and of the dependence of one fact on another. It is this knowledge that enables us, given that we can do something now, to know how to do a similar thing at a later time if we want to, because when we see how something comes about, in what manner, and through what causes, we can see how to make similar causes, if they come into our power, produce similar effects. So children are not endowed with reason at all, until they have acquired the use of speech. They are said to be reasonable creatures, because it is obviously possible for them to have the use of reason in time to come. As for the majority of men, they have a limited use of reasoning, for example, in elementary numbering. But reason is not much good to them in everyday life, in which their guide is not reason, which makes them alike, but rather things that differentiate them from one another. For they govern themselves, some better, some worse, on the basis of their differences of experience and quickness of memory, the different goals that they variously have, and especially of their good or bad luck, and of the errors they make, or that others around them make. They are so far from having science, or secure rules to guide their actions, that they don't even know what it is. They have regarded geometry as some kind of magic trick, and have made some use of it in that spirit. But as for other sciences, those who haven't been taught the starting point and some of the first moves, which would enable them to see how the science is acquired and generated, are in this respect like children who have no thought of biological generation, and are convinced by their mothers and nurses that their brothers and sisters are not born but found in the garden. Still, those who have no science are in a better and nobler condition with their natural caution than are men who make mistakes in reasoning, or trust others who have made such mistakes, and are led by this to accept false and absurd general rules. For ignorance of causes and of rules doesn't lead men as far astray as does reliance on false rules, and thinking that what they want will be caused by something which in fact will cause the contrary. To conclude, clear words, freed from ambiguity and clarified by exact definitions, are the light of human minds. Reason is the stride, growth of science is the path, and the well-being of mankind is the end of our journey. And on the other side, metaphors and senseless and ambiguous words are like will-o'-the-wisps. Reasoning with them is wandering among countless absurdities, and contention and sedition or contempt is their end. Just as having much experience is having prudence, so knowing much science is having sapience. For though we usually use the one name wisdom for both of these, the Latins always distinguished prudentia from sapientia, ascribing the former to experience and the latter to science. To make the difference between them appear more clearly, let us compare a man who has excellent natural dexterity in handling his weapons, with a man who has all those skills, and also has an acquired science of combat, a system of general principles concerning where he can hurt his adversary, or be hurt by him, in every possible posture or position. The ability of the first man would be to the ability of the second, as prudence is to sapience, both useful, but the latter infallible. In contrast to both of these, those who trust only to the authority of books and blindly follow the blind are like a man who relies on the false rules of an incompetent fencing master and rashly attacks an adversary who kills or disgraces him. Some of the signs of a person's having science, that is, being sapient, are certain and infallible. Others are uncertain. We have a certain sign when someone who claims to have the science of something can demonstrate its truth clearly to someone else, and we have an uncertain sign when only some particular events make good his claim to knowledge, while many others don't. Signs of prudence are all uncertain, because we can't observe by experience and remember all the circumstances that may affect a given outcome. But in any business in which you don't have infallible signs to guide you, you should rely on your own natural judgment. To forsake that, and instead to let yourself be guided by general opinions that you have read in books, generalizations that are subject to many exceptions, is a sign of folly, such as is generally scorned by the name of pedantry. Some men in parliamentary debates show off how well read they are in politics and history, but few even of them are like this when their personal welfare is at stake. They are prudent in their private affairs, but in public they care more about the reputation of their own intelligence than about the outcome of anyone else's affairs. End of chapter 5.